Thank you. So it's clear that there's big differences between the way you look at things and the way Pitt looks at things. And we're going to be testing you, as you both agreed to very kindly, 20 minutes from now. But before we go into those tests, crypto, what's your view on that?
It's not often you get me and Pitt agreeing on something, but in crypto, we probably agree. There are people who know a lot more than us. There are very smart people in that. There's a guy when I came into the industry, Heiko van Veenkaarten. I'm not sure if you've heard that name. He used to run the biggest hedge fund in the country in the early 2000s. I'm not here to promote him, but he's a very intelligent individual. And he spends his hours and days immersed in the world of crypto. So if anyone asks me, should I have money in crypto? I say, you know, take a percent, a couple of percent of your money, particularly if you're wealthy and you don't need it, almost like an insurance policy, and park it with someone who's a specialist. And that's what I believe in.
Or maybe we should get hold of Heiko and ask him for his thoughts on it too.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe you should.
What got you into this line rather than as a deep value investor or as a growth investor? In other words, why did you take this more flexible position?
So I like to keep the range of opportunities very broad. And that can be offshore, that can be local, that can be small cap, mid cap, large cap. I don't believe that at any particular point of a cycle, and Pitt recognized in fact as well that there obviously are cycles in the market, different industries are going to perform well at different times. You have underlying macroeconomic factors like regulation, interest rates, currency moves, whatever it may be. You know, just general technology changes. And those are going to mean that certain businesses are better positioned than others. And certain industries are going to struggle regardless. I mean, if you're in a global recession, you know, it's very difficult for a resource company to really be doing well. If OPEC ups their amount of barrels they're pumping and we're in a recession, the oil price is going to be low, then why would I want to invest in an oil company? So I think you have to look at the macro. I know Pitt would disagree and he would like to ignore the macro, and maybe over a very long cycle you can kind of ignore it and stocks will come and go right. We like to time it, and I think we have proved that we can time it. And you're not going to get it always correct and right, because obviously, you know, something like the Russian-Ukraine conflict emerged out of nowhere and, you know, spiked oil much higher than we had anticipated. And, you know, there are always going to be events that are never predictable. But on the whole, right now, we all in this room can say we're in a heavily inflationary environment. The Fed has made it absolutely clear that they're going to bring inflation down by pushing rates. And you can take those two facts and you can put them into various industries and various models, and you can work out which companies are now going to be more valued than others. There's a typical straightaway example of tech companies that are long duration, that are not going to make money or aren't predicted to make money for many years, but now have huge debt on their balance sheet. Rates rise. The predictability of them making future cash flows is not as certain now. Therefore, tech's going to come down. So, like, you've got to time it. You've got to play that. To me, you've got to play that. So you've got to be less of a growth investor at the moment, more of a value investor. And luckily in the hedge fund, we can do both. We can actually go short growth, long, we go short both. We can actually just short the whole world if we don't like what's going on. So I think that's, to me, that's paramount in effectively not limiting yourself to a particular strategy.
But what makes you different? You know, are you a Keynesian? Are you an admirer of John Maynard Keynes?
No, so you asked me before once about books.
Yeah.
And I've picked up a lot of different investing styles in books. The books that sat the best with me, recently I read this, and I mentioned to Pitt actually, The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. Very interesting. Very interesting about where you're born in the world, the type of community you're born into, who you study with, who your friends become, what opportunities beset you, etc. And it very much defines a lot of the path and the experiences that you have along the way. And I think you learn to look at money and wealth a lot differently after you read that book. I think that's a very good book. And then for me particularly, a very strange book, which is not about investing as such, but is about the experience of a hedge fund manager in Russia, which is Bill Browder, Red Notice. And it probably I'm the only person in South Africa that would really hit home with as a book that probably puts a red flag out on my type of career. Because when I've come across the people like the Resilient Group or the Steinhoff Group, you know, it's luckily I didn't take on the Russian government, but it made me think about the best way to approach particularly short positions and businesses that you have a problem with and, you know, how to, you know, potentially not get yourself into that type of a situation.
Bill Browder is an interesting guy. I met him in 2007 at a hedge fund conference, and again, I met with him in London in his offices when we were there in 2015-16. And what surprised me about him is he doesn't have a security detail. Because if you read that book, Red Notice, you think, how is he still walking? Incredible. Now, my story about the question about Keynes was different. He was the greatest economist of all times during his time. And he said, and he was a shocking investor, and he put it down to the fact that the markets can remain more irrational longer than I can stay alive. And that was really my point. When you have all your expertise, all your understanding, and you take a position, when do you decide that, shit, the market can remain irrational for longer than we can ride this position out? In other words, when do you cut your losses?
Yeah, so I don't know. We don't believe in stop losses, but very much believe in, you know, time is money. So a lot of these positions, and I know Pitt mentioned a couple now that he would buy because there's, you know, they're trading at big discounts to net asset values. You know, Remgro trades, for example, at a similar 40-45% discount to net asset value, and it's more liquid than the other two names. And they're more catalysts, in my mind, to unlock that value. And the assets are a lot more secure than some of the assets in those other two businesses that he mentioned. So for me, I always want to understand where I can get out, if I have to get out. So, for example, if oil collapsed tomorrow or HCR's offshore projects weren't doing so well, etc. You know, those aren't very liquid names like Sabvest. And, you know, we've got some serious assets under management. So I'm not so sure I would buy those two. So for us, you know, it's a day-by-day thing. I actually don't buy a stock. That's why I don't really buy into the whole Buffett and intelligent investor thesis, because, you know, it used to work decades ago before we had passive investments and ETFs, and we didn't have derivatives, and we didn't have information changing daily, and we didn't have current volatility. Yes, you could buy Anglo's 40 years ago and hold it for 20 years. I think that world has changed. And in fact, when we started at 361, we were actually benchmark agnostic. So we told all our investors, we are not interested in benchmarks. We're interested in picking stocks bottom up. And what we realized over the last number of years is that may work in the very long term, but the world's become very different. And we actually changed our strategy to become much more benchmark cognizant. So if the world's look, if Naspers represents 10% in a benchmark, and you're a long-only investor, and you're trying to beat that benchmark, and you want to have naught, you've got to understand you've got to have enough other stocks that are going to beat Naspers hands down. If not, you've got to have 10, and if you really like it, you might have to have 20. And we've changed our way we look at stuff in relation to those benchmarks.
But then you're looking at delivering according to the industry rather than delivering according to your clients. Your clients
no.
need
so surely. No, so if your clients come to you and they say, hello, 361, we want an absolute performance, then you don't buy our equity fund, because our equity fund is a benchmark, better or worse performance. Luckily, it's always been better. If you come to us and say, I want absolute return, then I put you either in a balanced fund, which is absolute, or flexible fund, or the hedge fund. That fund is only going to buy shares that we believe are going up, or going up relative to something else that we are short, that is going to outperform the equity that we are short. So this is the, to me, this is the important mindset an investor has to make. If an investor wants to allocate 30% to equities and is unprepared to take the equity risk, that's fine. You must go into an equity portfolio, and we are pretty confident that we can beat the equity benchmarks. But if a client comes and says, I want to just make sure I don't lose money, I want absolute performance over all times, that's what our hedge funds are for. That's what they produce.
What's the split between the two?
We have about 30%, 35% of our money in hedge funds, about another 20% or so in flexible and balanced funds, and the balance, call it probably just more than half or less than half, in long-only benchmark type portfolios.
Okay, time for questions. Is Jonty there? Bruce here? Oh, we've got the same team. Is everybody else a little shy? You don't have to be shy. Jonty.
A question. I think performance fees have gotten really a bad rap at this this conference. And for me, I would invest with a fund manager with a performance fee, because it's like hiring a top CEO and saying, listen, no bonus. You only get me incentivized on your salary. You know, he's not really incentivized as a top CEO to perform. You want to give him a high, you know, a massive bonus if he performs. In your view, and maybe cost some light, how should performance fees work? How should they be charged?
Yeah, so I think it really depends on the fund, to be honest. So, you know, exactly in a situation where you're running an SA equity fund, which is benchmarked against the SA equity or Cap Swix index, if you can beat that, for example, by a certain amount of percent over a longer period of time, then yes, why not? Should you not be able to take a performance fee? There's a lot of money going into the passive invest, in other words, the investment that's tracking that index. If we're able to produce, if we have done, double that index over the last couple of years, then if you want to be with us and you want that return, and we feel quite assured of, we feel confident in our ability to generate that return, then you're welcome to come to us, but you're going to pay a performance fee. If you're a very large institution and you're going to give us a few billion, you might be able to get a lower percentage of the performance fee and maybe have it capped. And in fact, all our funds, our retail funds, generally cap the performance fee. So it's not limited, unlimited, depending on how good your performance is. There is a cap to it. But I think it depends on the benchmark. In our hedge funds, for example, our hedge funds are based against cash. We're always looking for an absolute return. But then we found institutions a number of years ago said, we'd like a hedge fund based off how the market does. We said, great, we will run you a hedge fund with a Cap Swix benchmark and charge performances only if we beat Cap Swix. But then you need to understand that a Cap Swix benchmark fund is a fund that's 100% invested in the market. Therefore, our hedge fund that's trying to beat Cap Swix must also be 100% invested in the market. It can have longs and shorts and be whatever, but it also must run at that type of exposure. So I think it's a level of education that a lot of investors need to really understand performance fees and to understand the appropriate performance fee. And I think where Sean's right is many cases, performance fees are really set inappropriately. I mean, setting a performance fee based on how your peers does, if we had done that, we would have earned substantially more performance fees. You know, and it's just a matter of understanding exactly the fund and what you're trying to do.
Jonty, it probably was a little before your time, because it's a long time ago, but there was a magic company in South Africa called Prime Media. And Prime Media was flying. Willie Kirsch, he was the man. Whatever he touched was Midas-like. They had share options. And then the whole thing collapsed, and the share options were repriced. And I think that's really the problem that we have as sitting on the outside, serving not the asset managers, but our community, is to say we really don't like this repricing issue. If you got a performance fee and you have it over the term of the investment by the investor, then sure, then you got a chance. But the problem about repricing share options, as happens in many companies, is, oh, well, you know, okay, so we didn't make it there. Right, we'll start again and we'll actually upscale it on that side. Is similar to when people look at performance fees in this country. When you are a retail investor, you don't, many retail investors don't really understand it. And I think what we're getting and where we agree is the inappropriate benchmarks. And I'm really talking what Sean has taught me rather than anything. And secondly, why only in South Africa? Why are there no retail performance fees in the UK? Because regulation and competition have gotten rid of that. And a guy like Magnus was talking about, what's the chap from Fundsmith?
Terry Smith.
Terry Smith. He says it's outrageous that South Africa charges performance fees. That's how he's built his business, by not having performance fees. And in fact, he said he would never have had a business otherwise. So we're talking, I think, maybe different things. I get you. You invest. You got your team. They're highly incentivized. They're very, very driven and focused. And the kind of investing you do is so different to pretty much anybody else. Well, and if you didn't get performance fees, you probably would not deliver.
Well, particularly in the hedge fund industry. In the hedge fund industry, it's global. Global, in fact, we're on the light side. Most global hedge funds, some charge 2 and 20. We've even heard of 3 and 30 and 4 and 40. We're at the 1% management fee and 20% above the benchmark. Many charge from zero. So actually, in global terms, our South African hedge fund is actually very cheap as a hedge fund. And I don't think you should look at hedge funds compared to long-only funds. They're very different. We're entering into derivative structures. We're going short. We're trying to protect the capital all the time. It's a unique set of skills. And the people who work for us, you know, they're expecting also to be incentivized along the performance of those funds. I couldn't go with a flat fee of 0.6 or 0.9 or whatever it may be, and look to build a team of people that we've built over the last 16 years.
And I don't think that's the argument. I think the argument here is when people don't know what they are paying or they don't understand it, that it's a uniquely South African thing and that the benchmarks are arbitrary.
Absolutely.
That cannot be correct. So performance fees, if we talk about it and we think about it and we understand it, and next time we look at it, we can ask the right questions, happiness.
I want to explain one thing to you on a performance fee, just quickly to understand. Our hedge fund charges fees above a hurdle rate. The hurdle is interest rate at the time. So in 2007, interest rates were 10%. We made 30% that year. We could charge a performance fee. We had our worst year ever in 2008. We actually weren't well positioned. We lost 10%. The market lost 25%, but it's the only year we've ever lost anywhere close to that 10%. Because we lost 10%, and interest rates were 10, we were 20% behind where we could charge a fee for. In the following year, we made 30% again. So we made 30 in 2007, lost 10, and made 30% in 2009. Because we lost 10, interest rates were 10, and interest rates were 10 in the year after 2008, we still didn't earn a performance fee in 2009. And that's what people don't understand. So the client still got 30, minus 10 plus 30, which is a 20% per annum return over those 3 years, which I don't think many people got over that 2008 crash 3 years. But we only earned a performance fee in the first year and only started earning a performance fee again in 2010. So there's no reset in our hedge funds. It's a high water market. So that hurdle keeps growing. So if you're losing money, you've got a long time to go before you start charging again. The great thing is our fund has luckily done phenomenally well over time, and there have been ongoing performance fees, and I doubt we'll ever lose 10% again, just so you know, because the team is better, the structure is better, the protection is better, and
I think the reset is a very, very important issue.
Yeah.
It's a critically, critically important issue on that, because if you're going to take a risk, get some of the downside as well as the upside. It's unfair just to have a one-way bet. Well, we are ready for. Oh, do you want one more question? And then we'll have our debate.
Thanks. Just maybe something a little bit different. But what's your view on holding physical gold and silver as an investment?
So I actually don't like them as investments. As you can see, they haven't performed particularly well either over time. First of all, they're not a business. They don't generate cash flow and they don't pay you a dividend yield. So as even a value investor, it's very difficult. The only time I would say gold is of any use is as a hedge in times of potentially mass inflation where rates aren't rising and the world's about to crash. That could be now. So there are short periods of time where gold may protect you better than other investments. I mean, obviously, the amount of currency that's been printed by central banks around the world is concerning. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people have gone to the bit of the Bitcoin standard and left gold out and thought this is the new gold, the technology gold. So I'm not sure if gold will ever regain its splendor, but I'm sure there will be times where it does well. But as a long-term investment, not a big believer.
Alec, I just want to commend Cy for those phenomenal returns. And to say that, you know, those returns of the hedge fund, the very small drawdown, absolutely phenomenal. And, you know, not resetting the benchmark that he talked about, having a decent benchmark. And, you know, and I think the important thing as well is I'm pretty certain that Cy's clients all understand how his performance fee works and are happy, and he hasn't been receiving emails and letters complaining about the fact, given those returns. And so that's what I just wanted to say. You know, you get good performance fees and bad performance fees, and Cy deserves those performance fees, and they're phenomenal, and all credit to him because those returns are amazing.
Thanks, Sean. That's from you. That's quite a compliment. Thank you.
And you also army.
I only met Sean a couple of days ago. I told Sean I was watching his presentation live on and I was thinking, I hope our fun fact sheets aren't next. They weren't. Thank you.